Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This week, the government unveiled the 2014 budget, but it was quickly overshadowed by what appears to be an about-face by the finance minister and this government over its 2011 election promise of income splitting. Will it be a promise kept, or is the conservative commitment dead in the water?
There's a chance this budget was the swan song for Finance Minister Jim Flaherty. He's keeping vague about his future as speculation grows he could be heading for retirement.
So let's finally talk about that budget. The government is going to post a small deficit before returning to surplus next year. There are a number of consumer goodies, but are the financial policies good for Canada? We have a panel of experts weigh in.
And next week, Liberals gather in Montreal for their policy convention. It will be the first for Justin Trudeau as leader, and it will help set up the party's platform for the 2015 election. We'll tell you what you need to know before the grit gathering.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Tuesday, the Harper government unveiled its fiscal plan for 2014. Canada will post a small deficit of $2.9 billion, followed by a $6.4 billion surplus next year. But by Wednesday morning, the focus had shifted from the budget to an election promise from 2011.
At a post-budget event, Finance Minister Jim Flaherty expressed doubts his government would follow through with income splitting for Canadian families.
I think income splitting needs a long, hard, analytical look by people like Jeffrey Simpson and others, and by our various think tanks to see who it affects in the society and to what degree. Because I'm not sure that overall it benefits our society.
Income splitting would allow couples with children under the age of 18 to split up to $50,000 of their income for tax purposes. In the Conservative election platform, it stated families would save an average of $1,300 a year. But studies by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and the CD Howe Institute found around 85% of Canadian households would gain nothing from this measure.
So when Flaherty expressed his concerns, it looked like he was at odds with the government on a long-held commitment. At least a couple of other cabinet ministers appear to say they want to follow through with this promise, and this divide led to this exchange and question period between NDP leader Thomas Mulcair and Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
Does the Prime Minister agree with his finance minister that the Conservative plan is of no help to the vast majority of Canadian families?
Oh, the Right Honourable Prime Minister.
This is the finance minister and this is the government against the wishes of the opposition that brought in income splitting for our senior citizens. Something every year, Mr. Speaker, this government said in the last election, made a commitment that when we balance the budget is not yet balanced, but when we budget the balance, one of the highest priorities of this government will be tax reduction for Canadian families. I know, Mr. Speaker, that their plans would be tax hikes on Canadian families, but we believe in this party we should cut taxes for Canadians.
So, no clear commitment on income splitting in that answer, but it wasn't the only question the PM took. In fact, he was on his feet the first 25 minutes of question period, making it appear the finance minister was benched.
As headlines spread about a rift in the Tory ranks, Conservative sources started their work, telling journalists on the Hill that the Prime Minister actually shares the concerns of the finance minister. One report suggests it was the PM's strategy all along, and he wants to kill this election promise.
So we're going to analyze this now in the McLean's panel. Joining us this week are Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and political editor Paul Wells. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
What do you make of this messy communication strategy that the Conservatives seem to have had here?
Boy, it's hard to know what to make. A couple days before he tabled his budget, the finance minister was speculating about next year's budget, and he continued that speculation soon after. So it essentially nullifies the political effect of this budget as such. We're so busy, caught up in an argument about what might happen next year, that coverage of what they've done this year got curtailed. And his motivation is hard to plumb. The sense that we're getting, kind of as a Parliament Hill hive mind, is that this is a live debate within the government and that Flaherty jumped the gun in terms of saying it out loud. But the government seems to have really called into question the wisdom of its central economic platform from 2011.
And John, this doesn't seem like a terrible promise to break, considering all of the studies out basically saying that most Canadians won't actually benefit from income splitting, but there's still an issue here of credibility for the Conservatives.
Right. Well, I mean, the reason that it maybe isn't a bad promise to break is because lots of experts think it's a good idea. The reason it's a terrible promise to break is because a lot of Conservatives ran on it, liked it, and still like it. And I think the sales job the Prime Minister has to do now is largely within his own caucus and in his own ranks. So there's a serious problem there. To recover from it, though, is a sort of a two-stage thing, right? First, you recover from it internally, get your team on side again, get your people feeling like they know what the government and the party's policy is, and then you've got a sales job with the public that you can bring a coherent vision for tax relief, because sure as shooting, the Tories still want to run on cutting taxes.
So, Aaron, we saw some cabinet ministers come out and basically talk about how they think that they should follow through with this election promise. How deep is the divide in the Conservative Party?
I think that's the question to ask right now is, you know, to what degree is there a massive divide between caucus and cabinet, or even just the rest of the party and Jim Flaherty and Stephen Harper on the other side? It's one thing for Stephen Harper and Jim Flaherty to have discussed this and hashed this out and to have had reservations, but to have not informed seemingly anyone else of that decision is a big problem. Not simply in terms of policy implementation and how they go forward, but just in terms of you know, caucus dynamics and keeping a party together. You know, you can't sort of carry on too far, I don't think, if there's distrust or if there's anger or if there's frustration all around you. And that stuff, I think, eventually starts to wear on a government.
It's kind of confusing trying to follow the timeline here. Do any of you actually believe the sources and what they're saying, that this sort of was the plan all along to have Flaherty soften up the Canadian public before Harper announced that he's going to kill his election promise? Or what do you think actually happened in this case?
I don't believe that. I believe that Jim Flaherty has shown a propensity to speak his mind on a whole bunch of issues. The Canada Job Grant, the Senate, he's for abolishing it when the rest of the government's for reforming it. There's a bunch of factors like this. So I think the finance minister said what he thought in an interview and then in a scrum or a press conference situation, and the government has had to adapt to that new reality.
Yeah, I think he jumped the gun. There is no strategic advantage to slowly changing your mind on a central campaign promise. You either keep the promise or you dump the promise and deny that you ever made it. And so the idea that Flaherty wanted to launch some sort of Socratic dialogue on the ideal structure of the FISC is silly. I don't think this is a fatal problem for the government, but it's a problem.
Yeah, it's kind of, I find it, I love this idea that he wants a hard analytical look and a fulsome discussion on things. That would have been a lovely thing to have had in 2010 before the campaign promise was made. And if you do want to have this fulsome discussion about it now, then you have to probably have it with your own caucus and with your own MPs and your own cabinet ministers. And that's not something this government or probably any government has really encouraged, a long sort of drawn out discussion in which, you know, key policy planks are being debated, not just in the public, but within your own party.
John, you wanted to
add
to that?
Yeah, Cormac, there is one more thing to keep in mind here. Right now, we're talking about conservative tax policy, and particularly policy on cutting taxes for families. We're talking about it in a vacuum. In an election campaign, we'll be talking about whatever new policy they come up with, in contrast to NDP and Liberal policy, and that will be a very different dynamic. And Conservatives who are feeling bruised this week might want to think about that they'll probably be in a better position to defend themselves in a campaign than they are right now.
All right, and now let's take a look at the future of Finance Minister Jim Flaherty. In the budget lockup, he was asked about that, whether he would be delivering next year's budget. He always maintained that he would remain in this role until the books are balanced, which would mean 2015, but he changed his answer. We'll have a listen here.
In terms of doing budgets and so on, this is just the beginning of the work to do the budget. I have done 10, and that's a lot. We've been through difficult times, and the first five and a half years were a minority government, which was a different experience, as you can imagine, because you never know how long the government is going to last. So it's a more peaceful time now.
with a majority government. But anyway, we have work to do, and I intend to implement the budget.
And then I bugged him about it again in an interview for City News in the foyer of the House of Commons. He gave pretty much the same answer, but added an interesting line and then a little joke.
You know, I've got to, first of all, getting the budget done is just the first step. So now we have to execute it, and I have to do the bill and get the bill into the House and the Ways and Means motion and all of that. Once we get all that done, then we'll see where the land lies.
So you can't say for sure whether you'll be the finance minister for the 2015 budget?
Oh, I hope. We'll see. I probably will be.
All right.
Nobody else wants the job.
So what is going on with Jim Flaherty? Paul, is he hanging around to finish what he started, or is he preparing to receive that gold watch?
The decision is essentially the prime minister's and the minister's, and I'm not in their confidence. But I know that among conservatives who work with them, the perception of Flaherty has changed within the last 4 or 5 months. Shortly before Christmas, for the first time, he looked really shaky in a meeting with the provinces, with provincial treasurers. His parliamentary secretary did most of the speaking for him. And for the first time, very loyal conservatives have started to say they don't believe that Flaherty can hang on as finance minister until next year. And almost as soon as that speculation starts, Flaherty's line changes. And he stops being so adamant about delivering a balanced budget in 2015. I wouldn't be amazed and confounded if he sticks around till next year, but his body language suggests he's leaving before then.
You know, Cormac, it's interesting. A lot of the reaction this week has been negative to the confusion over their messaging, but you can bet it would have been a lot more hard-hitting and negative if were it not for the fact that we've watched Minister Flaherty struggle with health problems in public, look like a tired man who maybe in his last days of his long run as finance minister, even the negative publicity they've had is soft compared to what they would have had if he was a tough guy early on in his job. This is a guy who there's a lot of sympathy for in political circles, and he's in a weird way the government's benefiting from that right now.
And Aaron, I mean, he has this rare skin disorder with which he came out with last year, I think almost a year ago right now. Is it his choice, or is he being pushed out? Because he seems to have the will to stay in this job.
Yeah, I think there are obviously those health concerns that play into this. I think the other consideration is probably going to be that I can't imagine the Prime Minister wants an acrimonious falling out with his finance minister, who I suspect maintains a fair amount of popularity and sway in Ontario conservative circles. I'd wager at this point that he presents the 2015 budget, but I don't think he runs after that. I think that's maybe the exit point. I suspect that there is going to, on all sides, be some attempt to kind of ease out of this situation, just because that would seem to be the most sort of politically advantageous way to do it.
Well, the other option is he still makes the announcement that he's balanced the books with a fall fiscal update, and then doesn't deliver the 2015 budget. But if they need to replace him before the 2015 vote and have a finance minister in place showing a strong team heading into the election, who would be that person to fill in those shoes?
It's not obvious. We have this weird habit, at least since probably Don Mazankowski back in the 80s, of Michael Wilson, even more, sort of fetishizing the person of the finance minister. I mean, they've got an army of public servants in the finance department behind them. They've got a prime minister on top of them. Theoretically, it should be a job that any reasonably competent person could hold. But this kind of mystique sets in. So whoever is the finance minister, it's almost impossible to imagine someone else. And I think that's become a bit of a trap for Stephen Harper. He likes to have his advisors be interchangeable. And the one guy who's really not interchangeable is Flaherty.
With the recession, I mean, they wanted to have some stability there to try and make sure that the markets weren't fretting over a change in the finance department. But now, with the books being balanced, he's easier to replace. Would that be right, John?
I think definitely it's true that in really tough financial times, economic times, you don't want to mess with your A-team, so that means you want to keep the Bank of Canada governor in place if you can. You want to keep your finance minister in place if you can. But I also think Paul is right. It looks harder to replace those guys until about the day after they're replaced, and then we usually shrug our shoulders. This is a first-world democracy with, you know, pretty stable institutions, and you can do quite a lot without rocking the boat that much.
Aaron, any ideas on who might fill in the role, or do you not even want to touch that?
You know, you can throw out a bunch of names: Jason Kenney, John Baird,
Tony Clement.
You know, you can pick any number of names. My caution on this, I think, is that the number of ministers, the list of ministers who have been thought to be in trouble or have been said to have been deserving of being demoted, is much, much longer than the list of ministers who have actually been demoted or tossed aside. You know, it was just a few weeks ago that we were saying that Julian Fantino was on his way out, and now we've all forgotten about that. Health concerns aside, and maybe concerns about to what degree Jim Flaherty is speaking openly about things the government doesn't want him to be speaking openly about, I'm not entirely convinced that he's going to get tossed aside tomorrow.
Thank you again to McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and political editor Paul Wells.
Coming up, we'll break down the budget with several experts and take a look at the upcoming Liberal convention. We spent much of the show discussing the politics that came after the budget. Now it's time to look at the policies in the 419-page fiscal plan. As we mentioned at the top of the show, the government will post a $2.9 billion deficit this year. But in 2015, we will finally be back in the black in a big way with a $6.4 billion surplus.
Now, these numbers include a $3 billion contingency fund, which means if they really wanted to, the Conservatives could have balanced the books in 2014, a year ahead of schedule. In my interview with the finance minister on City News, he tells me why he chose not to take that route.
Well, we could have balanced them on paper, but it would have looked risky. And every year, we maintain a $2.5 billion contingency fund. Because we need it. Stuff happens. Bad things happen, unfortunately. The flooding in Alberta, Lac Mégantic. So we need to have a contingency fund for things like that that inevitably will happen. So I could have forced it into balance, but that's not what I want to do. I want to be able to say we have a true balanced budget. We're in surplus $5, $6, $7 billion, which is where we'll be next year.
The opposition is accusing you of doing this for election purposes, trying to make sure that you have the big headline coming out of the 2015 budget before you head into the vote. Did the election play a part in this?
They'd be, you know, the opposition would be the first ones to say if we had something terrible happening, you're not in surplus anymore, you're in deficit. You know, it's just playing politics.
Now, there were many consumer-focused initiatives in the budget. Cigarettes are going up in price $4 a carton. The government is eliminating the restrictions on shipping beer and alcohol across provincial borders. It plans to cap cell phone roaming rates. There's a promise to reduce the price gap between U.S. and Canadian goods, and pay-to-pay billing has been banned.
In addition to all this, the Harper government is giving $500 million to the auto sector and reviving its $1.4 billion Building Canada Fund to invest in infrastructure projects over the next decade. The government will also follow through with the Canada Jobs Grant, even though it was rejected by the provinces when it was introduced in the 2013 budget. But if agreements aren't in place with the provincial governments by April 1st, the feds will bypass the provinces and offer their cash directly to employers.
McLean's held a post-budget breakfast with former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, Laval University economist Stephen Gordon, and Ailish Campbell, Vice President of Policy and Fiscal Issues for the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Our political editor Paul Wells hosted the event and gets their analysis of the government's fiscal plan.
So we got a budget. It is being almost universally described as a kind of an overture to the real budget, which is next year. This is the last of the deficit budgets after several in a row beginning in 2009. But I like to say there is no boring way to spend $250 billion, and there is plenty of material to talk about in this budget in itself, and that's what we're going to be doing. I'll pass on to Kevin Page, and Kevin, maybe you have some stuff you can share with us.
Thank you. The first thing I look at is the economic assumptions. Does anything change? And I look, well, nothing's changing. This is almost exactly the same forecast in terms of outlook, which underlies the fiscal outlook that we had in the fall. Almost exactly the same fiscal outlook, again, that, you know, we had in 2013. So there's, okay, that's fine. Now I'm going to go to the back end. I'm knowing it's a thick book, right? So go right to the back end, you know, look at the fiscal planning tables. Okay, where are the new measures? And then I start going through the tables, like 78 measures. It reminds me of that, you know, that Bruce Springsteen song. Again, back to the songs. Bob the Boss should be in here. 58 channels, nothing on, right? And you know, all the sprinkles of, you know, all these different measures, and I go, like, where are they funding all this stuff? And then you realize there's a lot of more savings than just, you know, the public service and and the cuts to the military, which is kind of a source of funds over the next few years to help get, like, you know, every one of those big tables that you go through, job stuff or strengthening communities, they're basically forcing lapses on departments. Or they're telling departments you don't have any money more, or the programs that ended. Because you saw this line at the bottom of all these tables from, you know, funds from the fiscal framework. So again, more stuff department will never see. That's the from, and they're telling us where the two is, but they're not telling where they're scooping it. And then they would say more reallocations. And these monies would somehow fund all these, you know, these new little sprinkles of initiatives that Paul so eloquently talked about. Like, service levels have to change in this world. Like, if you look at those bottom line numbers again, the government really is focusing on spending restraint on that $115, $120 billion a year called direct program spending. That's, and they're taking $15 billion out of that by the time you get to 2015-16. Now, this guy isn't a real economist. I'm not a real economist, but he'll look at numbers and say, okay, what is the private sector productivity? What has it been over the past 10 years? What has been labor productivity? What has been multi-business factor productivity? And it's been almost zero. At best, you can get, you know, 0.6, 0.8% a year in labor productivity, but probably zero at total factor productivity. And you know, Minister, the President of the Treasury Board, who's not really being particularly nice in the public services, we're going to get unprecedented productivity out of the public service to deliver the same goods and services for just a lot less money. Like, how are you going to do that? And again, it goes back to what Paul just said. Like, we don't know the details. And I don't think there are any details. I think that just the government, and I've worked in, you know, for 27 years, been in all the cabinet rooms. I think this government, and I worked for this government too, they're just telling deputy ministers, find the savings. You know, find me an extra billion. And if you go back to, all the way back to budget 2010, you can see there's a nice table in the budget. I need $5 billion here in this budget, you know, annually, and then another $5 billion annually, and there's more savings in this budget. And again, if this is the story of the budget, and then there's nothing wrong with getting back to fiscal balance. There's nothing wrong with having a low debt to GDP. It's a noble thing. But there's a good way of doing it and a not good way of doing it. And a not good way means you're kicking the can down the road. So some government's going to look at this, whoa, and you know, potentially a new government, 2015 is going to inherit a nice surplus, maybe a series of surpluses, some room to maneuver, then they're going to lift up the cover and they're going to say, whoa, I got problems here in veterans, I got problems, you know, in D&D, I got problems in food inspection aids. We're going to have to fix some of this stuff first before we start going out and say, okay, let's fix productivity, let's fix income inequality, let's get green infrastructure going, and we'll go on and on. Thank you very much.
I sort of look at the things from the view from 30,000 feet for a lot of this stuff as a macro person. You know, this trend to ever smaller government, smaller in the sense of government spending as share of GDP, that seems to be the metric, the criterion that the government uses to describe itself as small. We're not spending much. Of course, that's that, you know, if you think about how free markets work, you sort of think, yes, you know, small market, small government means that it doesn't interfere too much in the market, lets the market do things, and then, you know, the government sort of swoops in at the end and redistributes. So, you know, just basically taxes, writes checks, and then lets the market generally work. That's, you know, even though the government likes to talk about being a small market, small government, it's not small in that sense. The government seems to love adding on regulations on top of regulations. My favorite one, right, most recent one in the budget was this, apparently we're going to see legislation calling for equalizing prices across between Canada and the United States. Well, my question is, well, hold it, why is there a problem in the first place? You know, dollars to donuts, the answer is there's some dumb regulation in there somewhere. So we have a regulation creating a problem, and the response is let's have a new regulation to solve the problem. That's not small government. This regulations are cheap and dumb sometimes. So that's like this. The line I had once was, you know, this government doesn't mind, you know, doesn't mind dumb government so long as it's cheap. So like, it's the notion of small government has to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt. They are very happy to interfere in the workings of the market, regulate things, add, you know, sprinkle the economy with any amounts of pork. You know, what's this thing that they have with snowmobile trails? I mean, why is the federal government doing this? And so there's lots of things there where the rhetoric of small government just doesn't really fit the reality. It does certainly fit the politics, and that's why, I guess. And just the point that the government is making about productivity in the public service. That too is something that economists are increased productivity. Who can be against increased productivity? The problem is that the public service is not like the manufacturing sector. Almost all of the wages, the costs there are labor, and it's like it's more susceptible to what's called the Beaumont's cost disease. The problem there is that you actually have to hire workers who have alternatives. And a classic example is a string quartet. A string quartet these days gets paid much more than a string quartet in the 1700s, even though the job is essentially the same. The reason why? Well, because a string quartet has other options to do. They can do other things. They're not necessarily more productive. So this is a problem that in the public sector, you really just can't cut and expect fewer people to do, to survive the same level of services. It really would be more honest if they were just going to cut this program entirely instead of clamping down everywhere, shaping off everything, and expecting that the same level of services would be provided.
Hi, Ailish Campbell. Nice to be here this morning. Thanks, Paul. Under the tutelage formerly of Kevin when we worked together at the PCO, and so, the song stays the same, but it also changes. So here we are, kind of outside the public service looking in, and it's, we've had great training. And so, when Kevin was talking about how he reads a budget, all the pages that he dances through really quickly, and for me, it was both the tables where, of course, a couple little things have changed. The growth projections look really good. We see some, certainly some restatement of the GDP inflation numbers, where we're certainly seeing a restatement downwards. But I'm going to challenge all of us to really broaden out our lens. I mean, as I would love to live, I'd love to just live in the rarefied world of the national capital region, where only this federal budget applied to my take-home pay or my spending or a business. But of course, businesses live, and as each of us do, both in the federal system as well as the provincial system. So I'm going to just broaden out my lens a little bit and take a look at some of the numbers that are both positive and also concerning me. The good news for business in this budget, the federal budget, of course, is that corporate income tax is staying stable. But you're seeing projections that, of course, the actual revenue taken in is increasing. And that means that we have a growing economy. That's obviously very positive. I'm going to join with Stephen and say that the talks of an austerity budget are totally misplaced. I think having lived in Greece for a time, having an Irish passport as well as a Canadian passport, we do ourselves a great disservice, I think, by putting Canada in that context. When if you look at what other austerity budgets have really meant, they've been much more severe. But we're at an interesting crossroads, and I think that's what Kevin is pointing to. The demographic challenge is coming, and we all know that. And what that means is that at some point, some level of government, and it may not be the federal government, but some level of government is going to have to increase taxes, or Canadians will have to accept lower levels of services. That's the reality that we live with. The interesting thing may be that Canadians are telling their governments at all levels, this is what we can live with. Maybe we can live with the current level of services because I want to have my take-home pay, where it is now. And we're going to have, the political class is going to have to learn how to live with that referendum, shall we say. Or, I think that's always the constant conversation we're having with each other. No, we're not satisfied. And there are areas that we want to look at. As a mother, of course, I'm always thinking about things like childcare and my after-tax income going to pay for things like that. So there's some really interesting, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and others have tabled some, good challenges, I think. And we'll continue to have that conversation. But that's the terrain really for the next year and a half. Are you happy with kind of a steady, predictable path? I think that's where the government has put us on. And for business, predictability is excellent. Do you think that there should be more services provided? Then, that is going to take higher taxes, and we're going to have that conversation, and maybe that's where we're headed. And I think we're certainly, because we live here, not just in Ottawa as affected by the federal budget, but also in Ontario. And I think the is Ontario has a fiscal revenue challenge, I believe, given its legislative statutory obligations, given the realities of infrastructure that needs to be renewed, given the realities of healthcare pressure. So we are going to see those issues come. And I think the terrain really shifts now, the action, shall we say, to the provinces that frankly have some of the stickier, harder issues to look at. And that's where for business, again, we're going to have to take a look at what I call Tiff Macklin's killer chart from his October 2012 speech, where he shows Canadian labor prices, kind of our relative competitiveness relative to the U.S., really slipping when you look at per dollar wages, productivity, all-in compensation. That should concern us. That's a big challenge that's sitting out there so that we can keep jobs in Canada, so that we can keep our economy humming, not just for what I think is a highly competitive services economy, highly competitive, but also make sure that we continue to make stuff in Canada. So I'd leave that as a challenge. I would also say, speaking more broadly, I think the government's put its finger on the real challenge facing all of us, which is labor market integration, labor market participation. We were really pleased to see the emphasis on skills trade. There is absolutely a demand, jobs going unfilled for skilled tradespeople. So including that apprenticeship program, the loans, including apprentices in the Canada Student Loans Program, I think very positive. The inclusion, the emphasis on people of disability, people with disabilities, including them in the labor market, that's smart. I'd like to think, like, I don't think that's any particular stripe of government. I think that's something that we would see under an NDP or a Liberal government. That's smart stuff. The First Nations Education Initiative, really important. So the emphasis on the labor market is really important. What one question I have outstanding, and maybe a member of the audience is much smarter than I and has put this together, but there was some interesting labor market information stuff in the budget, this jobs bank, and I'm not quite sure how it dovetails, for example, onto what Don Drummond suggested we need in terms of labor market surveys and information to do better job matching. But there was a killer chart for this budget for me. It actually wasn't in this budget document. It was in the, what do we call it, the jobs circular, the jobs pamphlet that accompanied the budget, and that was really about the number of unemployed Canadians, over a million, still looking for work, who some of whom need retraining or need to move regions in order to find a job, but a huge, two-thirds, where they're saying no skills mismatch. In other words, there's no job necessarily that matches what this person right now is capable of doing. How do we get those people into more active labor market measures? You know, not just the passive, here's the EI check, and, you know, keep looking for work. But how do we get those people into more active opportunities where they can actually look for employment, if not in their own region, then out across the whole economy? So again, for me, the budget is really just one little slice. Workmanlike is fine. Keep your eye on the provinces. As business people, I think, too, we're looking out globally. And I'll leave it there. Thanks.
That was former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, Laval University economist Stephen Gordon, and Ailish Campbell, Vice President of Policy and Fiscal Issues for the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. For the full audio of the post-budget breakfast, go to macleans.ca.
Coming up, we take a look at next week's Liberal Convention and which policies the Grits will be debating as they gather in Montreal.
On Thursday, Liberals from across the country will gather in Montreal for their biennial convention to debate and vote on new party policies. They'll include a proposal from the BC Liberal team to legalize prostitution, and whichever policies the delegates approve will help form the Grits' next election platform. Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes was able to catch up with Liberal MP and former leader Stéphane Dion to preview the convention.
So if we consider the budget, as you describe it, a failure to fix last year's problem, some confusing messaging on another big part of the Conservative tax agenda, how does that set the stage for your biennial convention in Montreal this coming week?
A big concern, because you see, it's very important that at this time where the economy is not great, where the growth is flat, where a lot of people are unemployed. In fact, the increase of unemployment in Canada, on the front of unemployment, we did worse than 14 OECD countries since the beginning of the recession. So we have a lot of concerns by the fact that the government doesn't seem to be coherent anymore. You have the minister, Minister Kenney, Minister Flaherty, contradicting themselves, and the Prime Minister unable to say who's right. If you compare with us, we are very united, ecstatic with our new leader. Many Canadians are, though you will have a lot of excitement. But in addition to the excitement toward Mr. Trudeau, you will also see a lot of hard work in order to listen experts coming to discuss with us, with our grassroots, about the best policies to help the middle class in Canada.
Are you comfortable with the, as I understand the stance of Mr. Trudeau, which is that we shouldn't really expect clear Liberal policies to come into focus until quite close to the election in 2015? What do you say about that?
We have no other choice than to do that. And if you remember what Mr. Harper did, it was the same. He came at the last minute with the tax cut for the GST. He would have proposed this policy a year before. Maybe it would have been destroyed by all the experts.
You're talking about 2006 now, 2005, yeah, 2006.
Yes, the way he had been elected. Mr. Chrétien came with the Red Book in 1993, the day of the election. He did not advertise a year before what he was expecting to do. It's a matter of strategy, but it's also sound policy, because we don't know really what will be the situation a year from now. It seems we'll have a surplus, but it's not sure. It will depend on the situation of the economy. We'll see also on the front of the employment where we are. So it's very wise for Mr. Trudeau to say to Canadians, I will have a platform, you will be impressed by it, but I have no interest to show it now. And also, why he would show it now when he's consulting Canadians and our own party? He wanted to have a very bottom-up process. So what will happen in Montreal next week will be a key step toward the building of our platform.
When you talk about how enthusiastic Liberals are with Mr. Trudeau and many other Canadians, I mean, his poll numbers are good, there's no denying that. I can't help but wonder why, if you reflect on it, why do you think the Conservatives were so successful in tearing down you and then Mr. Ignatieff and have had so much more trouble putting a dent in Mr. Trudeau's reputation and image? What do you think the difference is?
Partly it's a matter of timing. It's more difficult to win against Mr. Harper after 2 years of Harper, when people were telling us, you are still the old gang, you have been there for a long time, it's the turn of the Conservatives. After 9 years of Harper, it may be different. I don't think Mr. Obama would have won, we'll never know, but would have won after only 4 years of Bush. He needed eight. Timing is important in politics. Second, Mr. Trudeau has a great talent to communicate with Canadians. There is a very strong relationship between him and Canadians. We need to build on it. It's not enough, but it's a key point.
Could I ask, usually when I think about regulatory changes, I think, well, those are not the kinds of things that Canadian voters care about that much. It's hard to get them interested in it. But I wonder about this Elections Act reform. Do you have an instinct for how much you think it may resonate with people? Do you feel that's an issue that will only matter to people who look at the details here in Ottawa, or do you think voters will end up thinking...
Well, many people don't have the time to look at the details, but they will understand they have something unacceptable. To change the rules of an election a year before the election, when the other parties disagree with the rules the way they have been decided by the government. And the chief electoral officer said that. Usually you need to have an agreement between the parties. If one party is unreasonable, then Canadians will see this party is unreasonable. But in this case, the government never tried to build a consensus with the NDP and the Liberals. I think Canadians, without looking very in much details the bill, will find that very unacceptable.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes with Liberal MP Stephan Dion. Coming up, we take a look at this week in Question Period. We'll be right back.
From the budget to income splitting, there was a lot of action in the House of Commons this week. We're joined now by Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca. He brings us Question Period in review.
Budget week in Ottawa, when the topic du jour is supposed to be the government's economic plan for the next fiscal year. This week, Finance Minister Jim Flaherty's 419-page tome made all the normal headlines, but Question Period was more concerned about Flaherty's loose lips and comments he made about a key Tory promise from the last campaign.
Mr. Speaker, some interesting criticisms this morning from the Finance Minister about the Prime Minister's plan for income splitting. Does the Prime Minister agree with his Finance Minister that the Conservative plan is of no help to the vast majority of Canadian families?
On Tuesday, while Flaherty practiced his budget speech, Mulcair accused the Conservatives of rigging electoral reform in their own best interests.
What they're saying here is that the Conservative Party is going to be able to spend an unlimited amount of money on fundraising. Say it doesn't count in their limit. They're front-loading their cheating for the next election.
On Wednesday morning, Flaherty questioned the effectiveness of the Conservative pledge in the last campaign to implement income splitting, a measure that allows spouses to transfer earnings between each other to save on income tax. Later in the day, Mulcair asked Prime Minister Harper about Flaherty's doubts. The Prime Minister handled the question ably, albeit with a slip.
This government said in the last election, made a commitment that when we balance the budget is not yet balanced. But when we budget the balance, one of the highest priorities of this government will be tax reduction for Canadian families. I know, Mr. Speaker, that their plans would be tax hikes on Canadian families, but we believe in this party we should cut taxes for Canadians.
The NDP didn't let go of Flaherty's remarks. On Thursday, Deputy Leader Megan Leslie asked if the Finance Minister would stand behind his own words. Flaherty defended himself.
Because of our government, Canadians enjoy the lowest taxes that they've had in 50 years. We've done something that Liberals and NDP people don't know anything about. That is, we've reduced government spending. We've reduced government spending for 3 years in a row.
Flaherty never actually took back what he said. The opposition clearly wants to drive a wedge right through the middle of the Conservative caucus, and it hopes a senior minister doubting a long-standing Conservative pledge will do the trick. Flaherty and the rest of the Tory benches now get a week to lick their wounds as the Commons rises for a mid-February break, as they figure out new talking points. We'll see you in a week.
That was Nick Taylor-Vasey with Question Period in review.
That's it for this week's episode.
Join us next week when we'll have full coverage of the first days of the Liberal Convention in Montreal. We'll analyze leader Justin Trudeau's opening address to delegates and talk about what this weekend means for the Liberal Party's future.
Thank you to Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, Laval University economist Stephen Gordon, Ailish Campbell, Vice President of Policy and Fiscal Issues for the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, and Liberal MP Stéphane Dion. For more of your politics and your power, join us next week on The Hill.